ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Australia loses its bid to host the next COP climate change summit, disappointing the small Pacific Island nations. Also, the US President Donald Trump signs an order for the release of the Epstein files. And as Australia's social media ban for kids approaches, boarding school students worry about staying in touch with their families and friends.
I'm a bit concerned, like, how am I going to communicate with my friends back home? Because I only have, like, their socials, like, I don't have their numbers or anything like that.
Harder to communicate with your friends, like, as a boarder and being so far apart from them.
The federal government is being criticised by opponents and climate activists for giving up Australia's bid to host next year's major world summit on climate change, the Conference of the Parties, known as COP. After months spent campaigning to win the hosting rights, Australia has surrendered its claim to rival bidder Turkey. To try and save face, the Albanese government is still claiming a win, insisting it's done a deal that will see the federal climate minister Chris Bowen lead overall negotiations at the conference, as well as securing a pre-COP meeting to be held on a Pacific island yet to be revealed. Nick Grimm filed this report.
We're very pleased with the outcome.
The Prime Minister finding his climate change glass half full today as news sank in that Australia has missed out in its bid to host next year's COP31 summit.
We've come up with an outstanding result. COP31 will be hosted by Turkey. Turkey will have the COP presidency, but Chris Bowen and Australia will have the COP presidency for negotiations in the lead up to the conference in Turkey, but also at the conference in Turkey.
The two countries had been locked in a battle for hosting rights. If neither had blinked, the summit would have been held instead in the German city of Bonn. But Turkey wasn't inclined to back down. Dr. Ümit Şahin is head of the climate program at the Istanbul Policy Centre.
Such strong competition between countries about hosting COP is unprecedented. But I don't know, maybe it's because the COPs are becoming more prestigious lately, especially after the Paris Agreement.
In the end, it was Australia that relented.
Well, it may not amount to a row of beans in the end, but it was a great opportunity to put Australia right at the intersection of the big challenges we face around energy.
Innes Willocks from the Australian Industry Group is disappointed this country won't host COP31, but he acknowledges there will be positives from the concessions obtained, which includes a pre-COP meeting to be held somewhere in the Pacific in the lead-up to the main event.
The fact that we'll still have a key role in its development next year is important. The risk is that Australia does all the grunt work and Turkey gets all the glory at the end of the process. But as long as we're fully engaged, that's a positive thing.
Yeah, it sounds like you don't quite buy the Australian government's spin that this is an outstanding result.
Well, the more outstanding result would have been for Australia to lead and to host the COP meeting at the end of next year because of the opportunity it provided to lead the way in conversations around emissions, energy and the economy. So this in many ways is a second prize.
It is not the outcome that the Australian government wanted.
Richie Merzian is CEO of the Clean Energy Investor Group and a former Australian government climate negotiator who's been in Brazil for COP30.
Look, this is second best. I mean, the whole goal of this was to bring this whole event to our region. We've had three of these COPs in the Middle East and North Africa, and now the reality is we'll have a fourth. And so is this the outcome the Pacific wanted? Will they be able to bring the same kind of representation and pressure? I'm not sure, but it's still something, and we'll still be able to bring everyone to the Pacific for a preparatory meeting, a pre-COP, which will still be an important part of the picture.
And to that end, Pacific climate advocates still in Brazil regard the challenges they face as little changed.
Because the work does continue, at COP30, even though we're thinking about COP31, we're still here. We're still up late at night.
Fiji-based Drew Slatter-Lilidamu is at the summit with 350 Pacific, a youth climate advocacy network. She's focusing on the job ahead.
A lot of Pacific leaders put a lot of hard work behind this bid as well. So it's, you know, a mix of disappointment, but also acknowledging that the work, you know, regardless of where COP is, I think for a lot of Pacific leaders and climate advocates, the work continues every other day of the year outside of the 2 weeks of COP. But, you know, I remain adamant in my belief that the power is actually in our Pacific people and the way we continue to turn up. If we could have brought people to our region, that would have been able, you know, we would have been able to mobilize resources and really display the realities and the leadership of the Pacific.
That's Fijian climate activist Drew Slatter-Lilidamu at the COP summit in Brazil. Nick Grimm with that report. Anote Tong is a former president of Kiribati and one of the most prominent figures raising awareness of the impact climate change is having on Pacific Island nations. All the way back in 2004, he told the United Nations General Assembly that the very existence of Pacific nations is at stake, and that speech saw him dubbed a climate warrior. Speaking to me from Kiribati this afternoon, he was clearly disappointed next year's COP meeting won't be in the Southern Hemisphere.
The Pacific leaders had agreed to support the Australia's bid on the basis that the Pacific country will co-host. And the expectation that was that the Pacific leaders would have the opportunity to participate in the process and hopefully be able to have a greater accessibility to providing inputs, particularly in terms of what climate change, the implications of climate change are for the small island states in the Pacific.
What was the vision for the involvement of Pacific Island nations like Kiribati in the Adelaide conference?
Well, I think we've always been wanting our message to be heard in the midst of the huge COP meetings that are held at the international level. You know, we are a small voice in such a huge gathering. And we were hoping that would highlight what greater prominence being given to the Pacific countries, with Australia providing the lead role in this. It's just about being heard. I think it's just about getting effective climate action in the process.
Is this a setback, do you think, for the Pacific Island nations in terms of raising global awareness about the effect climate change is having in the Pacific?
Yeah, I'm not so sure that awareness is the problem. I think it's about getting action that is the problem. I think there is more than enough awareness. The science is very clear. The message has been all throughout over the years by the different successive COP sessions. And, it's about getting action now. With what happened in Paris in 2015 was ostensibly a landmark development, yet we're still not there. And there are indications that we are moving forward. But from our perspective in the Pacific Island countries, not fast enough, but perhaps not in time to avert the disaster that is coming.
As part of the compromise that the Australian government has reached with the government of Turkey, it seems the Pacific will host a climate meeting with global leaders ahead of the COP meeting in Turkey. Does that help ease the disappointment of Pacific Island nations like Kiribati at all?
Well, the question is, do we have a choice under the current circumstances? I think it's possibly the best outcome given the circumstances, and the decision has been made, an opportunity to make a contribution, a real contribution, I think is welcome. It would have been preferable if we'd been involved more directly in the planning process that we had hoped would happen if Australia were to be host, go jointly with the Pacific Island countries.
Yes, how much involvement did the Pacific Island nations have in the negotiations? I know you're no longer a politician, but what do you know about their involvement?
The Pacific has been very solid over the decades in the climate negotiations, and I think I'd like to believe that we'd make an impact on the way things have developed over the years, but still not enough. I think our voice has been very strong, particularly from a small group of small island countries. And I think in that respect that, small island countries, we don't always believe that we are relevant to these high-level international discussions, you know, given our size and relative size in terms of how we compare to large economies like United States, China. But I think the impact that we have made, I think, very significant.
Anote Tong is a former president of Kiribati and a prominent advocate for the Pacific Island nations in the face of climate change. Well, while the decision that Turkey, not Australia, will host next year's COP meeting is getting a lot of attention today, this year's Conference of the Parties in Brazil is in its final days. At the centre of fierce debate there is a proposal for a global roadmap to guide countries in the transition from fossil fuels. The Brazilian president wants an agreement reached by the end of the event on Friday. But the negotiations are being hampered by the fact the world's second biggest emitter, the US, isn't there. Luke Radford has this update for us.
It's been a gruelling few weeks for climate delegates in the tropical northern Brazilian city of Belém. Aside from trying to secure more ambitious action on climate change, they've been dealing with climate misinformation and financial challenges. Among them is Gio Abdoulaye, Minister of Environment and Climate Change for Sierra Leone in West Africa.
I think when we talk about adaptation, we need to explain to people what that means. It's like someone over time has built a tunnel under your house, and now you're seeing cracks, your house is about to fall down. The longer you wait for that to be fixed, the more expensive it's going to be. And if you wait too long, the whole house will fall down.
But the fiercest point of debate at this COP summit is a proposed global roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels and end deforestation. Brazilian President Lula da Silva has been keen to secure the agreement before a separate meeting of G20 leaders in South Africa this weekend. Tina Steggi is a climate envoy for the Marshall Islands in the Pacific.
We decided back in Dubai that we are going to transition away from fossil fuels. So the decision was made, but we just haven't been able to talk about how we implement that decision. And so this idea of a roadmap is something that actually has been discussed ever since. I think finally now have a political moment where it's been raised to that level of consciousness where everybody realizes that it's something that really has to be in this text.
But with 2 days to go, there still isn't any concrete agreement. Professor Christian Downey from the School of Regulation and Global Governance at the Australian National University says it's likely negotiations will go down to the final hours.
We've already seen, I think it's more than 80 countries have joined a call saying, let's get this roadmap in place to phase out fossil fuels. That was quite a dramatic intervention and included countries from Europe and countries from the developing world as well. But we also know that there's plenty of countries that are blocking that, particularly what's often known as petrostates, that is countries that rely on oil or gas, countries like Saudi Arabia, that have a history of blocking these types of agreements. So that will be the challenge, trying to get all these countries on board.
And the so-called petrostates aren't alone in their opposition. Despite being the largest climate conference in the world, COP has been increasingly infiltrated by lobbyists from the fossil fuel industry. There are an estimated 1,600 lobbyists at the event, which if counted as a single delegation would be larger than any individual country in attendance, except the host, Brazil. Christian Downey says the UN has tried to tackle that problem with new transparency rules, but it's unclear how effective they've been.
They've also launched new guidelines saying that, you know, if you're participating in these negotiations, you should disclose who's funding you to be there and make a pledge that your activities will be consistent with the objectives of the agreement to reduce emissions. So that's really good news that the UN is, you know, signalling that this is an issue and they're going to take it head on. But of course, these guidelines are optional and I'm sure many people won't be disclosing that information.
The conference has also been overshadowed by the absence of the world's second largest emitter, the United States, which has not sent an official delegation. Despite that, some progress has come. Earlier this week, South Korea officially joined the Power Past Coal Alliance, pledging to phase out its coal-fired power plants by 2040.
Luke Radford. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. The US President Donald Trump has signed a bill ordering the release of all files relating to the investigation of the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. His signature triggers a 30-day deadline for the US Justice Department to release the documents. The development comes after a presidential backflip, with Mr. Trump reversing his position and supporting the release of the files. Tanya Dendrinos has more.
He's signed many an executive order since returning to the Oval Office. But today, the US president signed a bill to release files relating to Jeffrey Epstein, a move he was long opposed to. He made the announcement in a lengthy post on his Truth Social platform, repeatedly pointing the finger at Democrats. He wrote, "Perhaps the truth about these Democrats and their associations with Jeffrey Epstein will soon be revealed, because I have just signed the bill to release the Epstein files." Earlier this week, the president urged Republican lawmakers to vote in favour of the release.
"I'm all for it. You know, we've already given 50,000 pages. You do know that."
That was a striking shift from his former position and led to the swift approval of the bill through Congress. It passed the House with 427 votes to one. The dissenting voice was Clay Higgins, a Republican congressman from Louisiana, who said he's been a principled no from the beginning. In explaining his vote, he said the bill reveals and injures thousands of innocent people, including witnesses, people who provided alibis, and family members. The Senate passed it unanimously. It left only the presidential signature, which came this afternoon. The US Attorney General is Pam Bondi.
"We will continue to follow the law with maximum transparency while protecting victims."
The Justice Department now has 30 days in which to release the files, but portions may still be withheld if they could jeopardize an active investigation or invade privacy. Democrat Chuck Schumer is the Senate Minority Leader. He's calling for the release of the full, unredacted files.
"No hiding, no game playing, no covering up. Pressure to make sure the documents are released in their entirety and not warped by a corrupt DOJ who's hell-bent on hiding the truth, bending the law, and protecting Trump."
Survivor groups have long lobbied for the release of the files, which could reveal more about the activities of the disgraced financier and his dealings. Donald Trump was friends with Jeffrey Epstein for years, but according to the president, the pair fell out in 2004. He strongly denied any wrongdoing in relation to Epstein. His post today calling out a number of Democrats, including House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. President Trump stating Mr. Jeffries asked Epstein to donate to his campaign after Epstein was charged. It's an allegation that was also levelled at Hakeem Jeffries by Republican James Comer, who's the chairman of the House Oversight Committee. Mr. Jeffries today responded.
"Was that a serious question or a serious statement from malignant clown James Comer, that I had Jeffrey Epstein over for dinner, that I accepted money from Jeffrey Epstein? What's extraordinary to me about the clown show on the other side of the aisle is that they lie with impunity on things that are objectively verifiable."
He's labelled the bipartisan enacting of the bill to release the Epstein files a victory for the survivors and the American people.
Tanya Dendrinos. Experts say one of the big changes in the Australian economy over recent years has been the decrease in the number of what are often called entry-level jobs, positions for workers with no qualifications or skills. New figures out today show just how severe that change has been, as Diana Damjanovic reports.
On a busy afternoon in Sydney's CBD, we asked people to think back to the days of their first job.
"I was a checkout operator at Coles and Springwood in Brisbane, and I started there when I was 15.
"And how do you think that first job has helped you with your future career or job?"
"It taught me to be on time, it taught me to follow the rules and the expectations and that I had responsibilities, and it was great."
"My first ever job was working at Domino's Pizza, actually, back home in Scotland. Social skills especially.
Working in the butcher shop with my dad, I was 12 years old. Just working hard in general and even communicating good with everyone at a young age, and still doing that now."
Decades ago, entry-level jobs for people with no qualifications or skills were abundant. But in the modern economy, times have changed and those jobs are much harder to find. That's a fact borne out in new data from Anglicare, which examines entry-level jobs available today. Casey Chambers is the Executive Director of Anglicare Australia.
"Well, it certainly is getting tougher. This is the worst figure we've seen in the decade that we've been doing this report."
The report found that in August this year, for each advertised entry-level job, there were 39 people registered as unemployed with Centrelink and 25 people with barriers to work, like having no formal qualifications. It's the highest ever ratio since reporting began in 2015.
In a sad way, we're not surprised because we can see the results of this happening to people coming through our emergency relief services, coming through, you know, all the kind of services we operate in.
The report also found entry-level jobs now make up just 11% of all advertised roles, and that number is falling faster than any other category. Back in 2006, entry-level jobs made up 20% of Australia's job market. One economist says what's driving this reduction is a changing society. Warren Hogan is chief economist at Judo Bank.
So what we have is a skills mismatch problem. That is, the jobs that we've had of the in the past, some of those are going or changing, and the skills and the jobs of the future are different. We need to retrain and reskill people for those new jobs.
And the problem is not going away.
We may see a situation that even though the economy continues to improve, we may see unemployment rise. Even though the economy's okay, companies are going to try and grow through technology application rather than hiring people. But more importantly and more sadly is we're probably going to see more and more examples of redundancies and layoffs where essentially these jobs of the past are lost, and they're lost before we find the jobs of the future.
Casey Chambers echoes the issues. She says the problem will only get worse if people aren't given the right skills and training.
We know that we're going to need tens of thousands extra positions in disability and aged care in the next couple of decades. So they're not entry level, all of them, but they're incredibly rewarding professions and people can start and come in at entry levels.
Casey Chambers is the executive director of the charity network Anglicare Australia. Diana Damjanovic reporting. Australia's social media ban for kids under 16 comes into force in early December. The federal government argues it's needed to protect children's mental health. But many students in boarding schools are worried the ban will make it harder for them to keep in touch with family and friends back home. Lucy Cooper reports.
It's lunchtime at Townsville Grammar School in North Queensland, and I'm talking with 15-year-old EJ about the Australian government's social media ban for those under 16.
Oh, I just know it's going to be annoying.
He's from Papua New Guinea, but currently lives in Hong Kong and attends boarding school in Australia. He regularly uses Snapchat to talk with his sisters.
Loss of just overall interaction with other people, and it's harder to communicate with your friends, like as a boarder and being so far apart from them. It's a lot of things to go through.
EJ and his mates are already talking about ways to get around it.
VPNs, using each other's ID, maybe just like someone older, the age of 16, has like an older brother or sister, maybe use some of those and then use theirs and they use their sisters or brothers.
Thousands of kilometres from her home in PNG, 14-year-old Cleo says she does not know any of her family or friends' phone numbers. Instead, she uses social media to stay in touch with loved ones.
I'm a bit concerned, like, how am I going to communicate with my friends back home? Because I only have, like, their socials, like, I don't have their numbers or anything like that.
A world-first ban, social media platforms will be expected to detect and deactivate or remove accounts from existing underage users, but they don't need to verify the age of every user. Dr. Amanda Watson is a communications researcher at the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University. She says the government's bringing in the ban to tackle a range of issues.
It responds to concerns about a range of issues to do with children's social media access and potential negative impacts, such as negative impacts on mental health through, for instance, bullying amongst children, possible issues to do with child sexual abuse and grooming of children, and so on.
Dr. Watson says there is uncertainty about what the ban means for the 21,000 boarding school students across Australia.
I'm not quite sure how the Australian government is going to handle people who are here temporarily, so it would potentially have an impact on their ability to maintain social contact with family and loved ones in their Pacific home country. So certainly that's something that maybe hasn't been given much thought to as this legislation has been developed.
Back in Townsville, and Tafaru, a 15-year-old also from PNG, uses TikTok and Snapchat to stay in touch with loved ones. She'll be unable to use either in the coming weeks, but she welcomes the ban.
I feel like it's good to an extent because some kids like really rely on social media.
In what ways?
Well, they use it for, like, to regulate their emotions and just, yeah, when they're bored.
Fellow student Dane, a boarder from Melbourne, believes parents should be left in charge of social media management.
I feel like it should be up to the parents more than a blanket rule imposed on everyone. If they allow me to do it, I reckon I should be allowed to be on it.
That's Townsville boarding school student Dane, Lucy Cooper, with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast is available on the ABC Listen app, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump resisted it for so long, but after a massive U-turn earlier this week, the remaining Epstein files are set to be released. The US House of Representatives overwhelmingly voted in favour of a bill to force the release of the documents. Today, David A. Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic, on how Trump was backed into a corner. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.